Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
All right, welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimanchu, and I'm here with our showrunner, my co-host tonight, Dr. Sam Mazier, as well as our producer, Brian Ward. Say hi, guys.
Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Today, we have an excellent guest tonight, Dr. Doherty, to talk about vaccine-preventable illnesses. That would be the MMRNVs of everything. So, but before we get into it, Sam, want to remind us what this show is about?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
Tonight, we had a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Walter Doherty. Dr. Doherty is a professor of pediatric infectious disease at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He has helped run clinical trials on children's COVID vaccine, served on numerous vaccine advocacy committees, and has ongoing research investigating ways to combat vaccine misinformation and increase vaccine uptake in rural areas. He's also helped kickstart and appeared on a documentary on vaccine misinformation, Vaccination Against the Misinformation Virus, which aired nationally on PBS during the COVID pandemic. He has had a long-standing interest in vaccine misinformation and vaccine-preventable diseases after seeing several unimmunized patients die of Hib meningitis. He has also published two articles on how vaccines are portrayed in movies, which required him to watch nearly 400 films in 2 years, resulting in a, quote, frightening level of knowledge of bad sci-fi movies.
Wow. I mean, everyone's going to really enjoy this discussion. I really wish we had asked him a little more about those bad sci-fi movies, but that'll have to wait until the next time we talk to him. So let's swell into the discussion. Oh, that wasn't a good one. Let's break out into our main discussion.
Ooh, there we go. I'll take that. Breakout.
All right. Yeah, breakout. All right. Let's time to rush forward to our topic of the day. Dr. Doherty, thank you for coming to our podcast. First, because we're an informal group, is it okay if I call you by your first name?
Yes, that's fine.
Excellent. Well, Walter, thanks for coming on our episode. Do you mind maybe describing yourself a little for our podcast listeners to tell us a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, so I'm Walter Doherty. I am a perpetually tired and exhausted father of four, avid sports fan, and someone whose primary goal every day is to try to make sure my kids still have a home-cooked meal at night, whether they want one or not.
Oh, I feel you. We've been trying hard to just make it through every day and make sure there's some food on the table at nighttime. I think a lot of people feel you, so.
Yeah, and you guys say that as both parents of four, parents of one, and still having the exact same problems, and very tired, nonetheless.
Unfortunately, I don't know if it's scale. I mean, it scales because, well, it scales in a way that you still have to get food on the table, just different amounts.
What did they say? You go from man coverage to zone coverage at three, and then it's just everything zone coverage from there on.
I like that.
Absolutely agree with that. Any other questions? We have a huge episode for us today. Maybe we should just jump right into it. What do you think, Brian?
That sounds good. Let's just start by talking about vaccination rates. As pediatricians, we spend quite a bit of time partnering with families to prevent serious illnesses through vaccines. But unfortunately, vaccination rates are decreasing and vaccine-preventable illnesses are reemerging. So I wanted to talk about some of the things that we can look out for, some cases, so that as pediatricians, we can recognize things like measles, rubella, mumps, and varicella when we have those on the differential. To set a groundwork for the conversation, though, Dr. Doherty, can you talk about how vaccination rates are declining and if there are any populations that are specifically affected? Talking about disparities, and are disparities widening when it comes to vaccination rates in America?
Yeah, and I think this is a moving target. So you sort of had pre-COVID data, COVID data, post-COVID data, and then 2024 on data with a lot of changes potentially down the pipeline. So it's always a moving target. I think a couple of examples I could think of that I'd like to talk about because I think they can be related right to a disease outcome in question. Because sometimes I think it's a little abstract if you just talk about some particular group has lower tetanus coverage or whatever. It can be lost in the shuffle. But HPV is one that I like to talk about. So Black women have higher rates of cervical cancer. We know that. There's also data that shows that that same population is, unfortunately, has lower rates of coverage with the HPV vaccine, which can prevent cervical cancer. And Black children are less likely to complete the HPV vaccine series. And in the same vein, American Indian, Alaskan Native children have one of the lowest rates of influenza vaccine uptake. It's around 30-ish percent, roughly, whereas other groups sort of live in the 45 to 50% uptake. Their rates of admission for influenza can be 3- or 4-fold higher than other groups. So those are two examples where we see a significant reduction in disparity in vaccine uptake with a corresponding increase with the disease in question.
You know, all these different areas which you're discussing today, you know, all these different specific examples you've brought up, you know, obviously lots of different things go into it, whether it's which social determinants, whether there's cultural factors, whether there is factors in terms of availability. Can you discuss a little more about what are the largest areas which you think we should be addressing right now?
Yeah, I think in terms of increasing vaccine uptake and addressing hesitancy and all the above.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, you know, there's, unfortunately, there's decreased uptake in rural areas. So that's been an increasing problem just in terms of availability and interest in vaccination. And I think getting vaccines to some folks is an issue too. So I think I'd like to see work and research in prioritizing vaccine delivery, so talking about like non-traditional methods to vaccinate, more involvement in the community, so getting trusted messengers to talk about vaccines in a community and getting community involvement. And that can involve things like mobile vaccination clinics, non-traditional sites where you might be able to give some vaccines, having peer counselors, for example, that could be available to talk with folks that ideally would live in a community and can address some of the concerns that might be community-specific and population-specific.
That's great that you're able to talk, you brought that up, because I don't think that's something that people think about right away about these sort of non-traditional avenues. So today we're going to talk about a couple of different vaccines separately, and we're going to obviously talk about them in a little more detail. I guess one question I want to ask before we get into it is, as a whole, is especially when we're looking at vaccine hesitancy and we talk about the ways to educate our parents, how do you go about talking about vaccines? Do you have a layman's sort of script that you discuss when you talk to them, talk to parents and families about vaccines, or not?
Not necessarily. Maybe I should, but I will tend to, you know, I think contextualize a discussion based on the family that's in front of me, and it can be quite variable, I think, in terms of their experiences, their specific concerns. You know, vaccine hesitancy can vary based on the type of vaccine, whether it's a booster shot or not, the age of the child, the background of the kids, what time of year it is. And so I think I think it's a little bit better to have more of a freewheeling approach. And I also have found sometimes that if you come in with a script, can be a little bit off-putting at times to parents. Whereas if you have a more conversational tone that you can get without a script, I think it's a little bit easier to reach them at times.
Well, why don't we start the conversation then with a case from Cashlack Children's. You are a physician in a walk-in clinic when Casey Koplik, a 3-year-old, previously healthy and unvaccinated young patient, comes in with a fever, cough, and a whole body rash. What information is most important to you to gather at this point from the patient and the family?
Yeah, and sorry, did you mention the vaccination status?
Unvaccinated patient.
Unvaccinated, okay, yeah, of course. So information with the family. So I think the first thing you want to ask about is, when you get in the room there, is risk factors. And so I sort of would walk in there and think, okay, you know, you got this unvaccinated person, let's assume the worst, you know, maybe it is some vaccine preventable disease, fever and rash, you're kind of thinking about things like measles and rubella, with measles being much more common just epidemiologically. And then you want to, you know, ask about ways she could have had measles. So she have somebody she was in contact with that had a similar illness, or multiple folks, as she traveled internationally, just to get a rough idea of possible exposures.
You know, and we kind of tease this a little bit. I think it's probably more helpful to talk about what are the symptoms of measles? Why am I even thinking measles when I walk in that room?
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe we can start there and then we can back ourselves up a little bit based on the things that we see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with measles, unfortunately, it can at times mimic a bunch of other stuff because lots of things cause fevers, lots of things cause rashes, lots of things cause cough. So I kind of like to think about some of these vaccine-preventable diseases like those puzzles you may have done as a kid where there's like two pictures and one of them's a little bit different than the other one. So it's like a lady with a hat and a handbag. And they say, how many differences can you see between the two pictures? And, you know, one picture has the lady with a green hat with white flowers. And in the next picture, it's like a white hat with green flowers. And you have to identify them. And sometimes your mind plays tricks on you. And you look at it and you say, oh, my gosh, that handbag actually was brown in that first photo. And it's you know, black in the other. I didn't notice that. And that's kind of what you're doing as a clinician, I think, when you walk into a room like this and you hear a story, is you're trying to see, like, what's different about this kid that might be measles than all the other kids I've seen over the last day or week or month or year. And so, you know, some of the things that I would look at with measles is it causes a non-exudative conjunctivitis frequently. And there's the three C's you may hear about: coryza, runny nose, cough, conjunctivitis. There aren't too many things that cause a non-exudative conjunctivitis. So Kawasaki's can do that, leptospirosis, measles, a few other things. But that kind of catches my eye because you see a ton of kids with pink eye, right, and goopy eyes. But that non-exudative conjunctivitis, I think, kind of jumps out at you. Rash is another one. So if they're coming in with a rash, and we can back up and talk about the prodrome in a bit, but it's a classic morbilliform rash. And has this really interesting pattern where it'll start high and go low. So it'll start in the face and then move its way down, the cephalocaudal progression, which is kind of interesting. And it's a little bit worse on the head and the forehead. And so that's kind of unique. And then the other thing that I think is interesting is if they come in later, the rash will reverse itself. So it'll classically go away at the feet first in the lower extremities, and then lastly on the head. So it's like top down, and then it reverses itself when it resolves. So those are a couple of things that catch my eye. The Koplik spots are something we should probably talk about too, especially given the surname of this patient. and those are classically, you know, taught in medical school, and there are these sort of bluish white things you can see in the buccal mucosa, classically next to the molars. They could be on the palate and stuff. But unfortunately, in one of life's little bitter ironies, the Koplik spots tend to start going away at the time the rash appears. Kids appear when the rash appears. So oftentimes when the child comes in, they're not going to have Koplik spots because mom's waited a day or two until the rash appeared and then brings the kid in. But I think as an astute clinician, what you could do is if you see Casey Koplik and she comes in and she's got a fever and in this prodrome phase, which can last about 4 days, and you see unimmunized kid coming in with fever, myalgias, no rash, that's when you can look for the Koplik spots because probably it's a virus, but it could also be the prodromal phase of measles. And so you're going to look in that kid's mouth, right? You get the otoscope off the wall, you have them say, ah, just kind of look around and see if there's a Koplik spot there. And you can be the world's greatest clinician if you picked up a kid with measles in the prodromal phase by looking at those Koplik spots. And so that can be another clue.
Can you help me a little more in terms of sort of differentiating measles versus maybe some of the other things that we need to consider in differentials? It sounds like you already brought up, like, during the prodromal phase, we had to, you know, obviously viral exanthems can be considered. How do I differentiate between measles and rubella?
Yeah, so rubella is used to be known as German measles. And I think it's actually helpful to think of that because it's not just this historical, useless piece of trivia, because it really does share a lot of similarities with measles, which is why they called it German measles. And for a long time, they thought it was one and the same. It was just this slightly atypical version of measles. And it wasn't until the 19th century that someone said, well, this is probably something different. And then they named it German measles or rubella. So rubella can unfortunately present with a conjunctivitis. It can present with a rash. It can present with fevers. It can present with some respiratory stuff. It can also have a rash that starts on the head and moves down. And that's the German measles aspect of it. What's a couple of different things about rubella. First thing, and I'm going to mention this even though it's not a clinical presentation, it's exceedingly rare in the United States. There isn't any endemic rubella in the United States. Every case that we've had in the last 15 or so years has been imported. So you're way less likely to see that than measles. That's the first thing. The rash of rubella is also varied. So you don't have that classical morbilliform. It can look like a scarlatiniform, scarlet fever type rash. It can look macular. It can be macular papular. It could be morbilliform. It can look quite different than a classic measles rash. It also does not do that reverse resolution. Because remember, measles starts head to toe, resolves toe to head. Rubella actually goes head to toe and then resolves head to toe. So it doesn't have that reverse pattern. The measles rash also can turn kind of coppery when you're 3-4 days into the rash, kind of a coppery brown. Rubella doesn't do that. Another classic thing with rubella is that it'll present with classically postauricular or occipital adenopathy. And you'll see that pretty much every sort of source you read. Measles doesn't do that. Rubella doesn't present with complex spots either. It can present with an enanthem in the mouth, but you don't get that like white, bluish type of spot. So the absence of the complex spots, the unusual adenopathy in the occipital region, the differential pattern of how the rash resolves, and then the varied appearance can help you differentiate that.
And so I think the differential diagnosis is really important. I just want to kind of summarize this a little bit, because as you've been talking about this, I've been thinking, okay, I walk in this room, I'm thinking, generally thinking viral exanthem, you got cough, congestion, maybe conjunctivitis. You're like, okay, I don't see anything there. There's nothing dripping out. It's looking less like viral conjunctivitis. Maybe I'm thinking Kawasaki disease. I got a rash throughout my body. I've been febrile. I have, this limbic sparing conjunctivitis, maybe. But it sounds like, in this case, you have that cough and you still have the URI symptoms and things like that. Just while we've been talking about it, is there anything else we should be paying? Oh, and then for the rubella, just to say that out loud, like it sounds like, it could be anything, but also it's exceedingly rare. So when you talk about pretest probability for rubella, you should just start very, very low. Is there anything else we should be thinking about when you think about differential diagnosis? Because otherwise, we're going to jump into that room and start talking about the measles itself.
Yeah. I think leptospirosis can sometimes do that. It can cause fevers and a non-exudative conjunctivitis and some pulmonary symptoms and varied symptomatology. So I'd put that on there as well. But those are, I think, lepto, Kawasaki's, sometimes toxic shock syndrome, rubella, measles, Kawasaki's given the age, obviously, if it's the right age range. Those are all things that I would think about.
Awesome. And so, we know this patient will say we looked at their medical chart before they came in. We knew that they did not receive any vaccines, even as they got roomed, because we can see that. And this is a 3-year-old. As we're about to go in the room, what type of precautions should we take? We talk about the transmissibility for this virus all the time. Can you kind of go into that a little bit as we're about to step into the room?
Yeah. So one of my favorite stories of transmissibility, which I think illustrates it better than any discussion about like R-naught or herd immunity threshold, is this, this story that occurred in the Minneapolis Metrodome in the 1990s. So the Metrodome was where the Twins baseball team and the Minnesota Vikings NFL team used to play. It was this big 60,000 seat indoor stadium. And they hosted the Special Olympics World Games there in the early 90s. There were about 60,000 people in the stands. And there was an athlete on the field from Argentina who had measles, although nobody knew it at the time when he was on the field. There were two unimmunized people in the upper deck that were sitting underneath the Jumbotron who contracted measles. And it was the same strain of measles as the Argentinian strain that athlete had. So these two folks were unimmunized, sitting in the upper deck of a 60,000-seat stadium and caught measles from a guy on the playing field. And so I think of that story and I think like, well, okay, imagine if that same person was walking down Costco, right, with a shopping cart, how much damage they can do. So I think about that when I think about the transmissibility of this, because it's really a big deal. So this is something that would get airborne isolation. So you'd want negative pressure room. You'd want to wear an N95 mask when you go in if you have a high index of suspicion that this could potentially be measles. Other thing I like to say is it's better safe than sorry. So measles, for whatever reason, and you know we could brainstorm why, I think really captures the imagination of the media as sort of emblematic of vaccine failures. So you know these measles outbreaks always sort of get picked up by the news in a way that maybe a case of Hib meningitis would not. You know, you can think about the Disneyland outbreak in 2014. So you don't want to have like Wolf Blitzer and Anderson Cooper showing up with their CNN van in the lobby a week later wanting to interview you about the big measles outbreak that you missed. And so I always think about that when I go in a room like this.
And you're talking about, you know, TV is like, hey, on this all the time. Like, this is a huge deal. How dangerous actually is measles? Like, is this something that, I clearly it's contagious, but is it dangerous?
It can be. And I think sometimes we can get, you know, you could probably overplay the danger, to be honest with you, at sometimes compared to certain other diseases. And I think you can also, you know, underplay the danger as well and say it's no big deal. You know, about 1 in 1,000 kids that get measles will get encephalitis, more common in older kids. There's this thing called SSPE, subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is a fatal complication of infection. If you get infected under the age of 2, pretty rare, but you can then present when you're like 10, like 8-10 years later with this fatal, you know, neurological disorder with cognitive decline.
Sounds terrible.
And die, yeah. And so it's, and I haven't seen that before, it's very rare, but that's, you know, fairly well described. I think it's also useful to think about pre-vaccine era, because, you know, you see these things when you're reading like CDC MMWR reports and they kind of throw numbers at you like there were 500 cases of measles and whatever. Before we had the vaccine, there were maybe like 600,000 cases a year and about 500 kids died. So that's about 1 in 1,000 kids would die from this. So, you know, I like to tell my learners that, you know, something may be rare unless it happens to you or your kid, and then it happens 100% of the time.
Yeah. No, obviously. Yeah. So that's kind of a background. We stepped in the room, say we stepped in the room with an N95 because we're being smart and conservative, you know, as you said, like there's no reason why not to.
Contact precautions too, right?
Yes.
Yep, everything from N95 all the way down, and so we have enough suspicion because let's say we hit all the pieces that you just mentioned. We have enough suspicion that we want to test for measles. How is that done? What test should we send? All the good things. How do we go about doing that?
Yeah, so you basically got a couple of options: serologies or PCR. And if you understand a little bit about how they work, it's helpful. So, you know, the IgM appears around 3 days, roughly after the rash, between 3 and 7 days. So that's an option depending when they come in. The PCR turns positive around the time of the rash prior to the IgM. So that's going to be a little bit more sensitive. So typically you'd want to get a PCR, so that's like a throat swab, oropharyngeal swab, and a blood PCR, and then get an IgM as well. You could also, as a third tool, get a paired IgG, and if you see a fourfold rise over a few weeks, that can also be helpful. That's going to be less helpful, though, in the acute setting.
Are there any other tests that you would consider adding at the same time, especially as we're thinking that, you know, I guess if we have high enough suspicion, especially since measles seems very, by symptoms, you can probably diagnose these patients based on what you've discussed. Is there anything else you would consider sending at the same time?
You know, I think if there's anything else on your differential diagnosis, for sure, you know, if you're not quite sure what's going on, and sometimes it can be a little bit tricky. Maybe the rash is fading or the rash has not quite yet declared itself, or they're a febrile at the time they come in because they've had a bunch of antipyresis, or the mother's not a good historian or father's not a good historian. And then it might be a more puzzling picture. And I've seen a few cases like that. And then I think you want to expand your reach a little bit. Maybe you look for other respiratory viruses. You do consider something like Kawasaki's and do that workup. If you're just looking for measles, though, I think that's going to be where your money's at.
And do you think you should also send rubella, you know, rubella PCR, et cetera, when we do this? Or is there little value in that, again, because the pretest probability is just so small?
Yeah, I think if when the... It's a great question. I think if you have a clinical concern for it, yes, and particularly if there's some sort of exposure. So again, the cases tend to be imported. So if this is a child who's immigrated somewhere where there is endemic rubella in Africa, for example, then I'd be much more interested in sending that at the same time. If you're finding some of those red flags for rubella, like occipital adenopathy or posterior auricular adenopathy, or there's something ringing your bell about it, like the rash isn't quite morbilliform, then I think that it's a little more reasonable to pursue that rubella. But if it's a kid who hasn't traveled anywhere and doesn't have any of that stuff, I think it's probably relatively low yield.
And just to confirm, is that also blood and oropharyngeal PCR or nasopharyngeal PCR, or is that just nasopharyngeal PCR?
And you're talking about for rubella?
Correct, yeah.
So rubella actually can be a urine PCR. It's actually
glad I asked.
Spread pretty well in the urine as well as the oropharynx. You can also get an IgM as well. The IgM turns positive a little bit later than the measles. So I think it's like around a week or so after the rash occurs. So it's going to be a little bit more positive. But PCR and IgM are going to be your two better options there.
So once we've diagnosed measles, how are we treating measles? Are we treating, well, we'll just start with that. How are we treating measles?
Yeah. So first off, supportive care, obviously, hydration, all that stuff. I think, you know, when you talk about treatment for measles, we obviously don't have an antiviral. You might read some stuff about ribavirin, which is kind of a drug in search of a disease. But really, it comes down to vitamin A, which I think is a fascinating topic, because if you look at the Red Book and most textbooks, they'll recommend giving vitamin A in someone who's sick enough to be hospitalized with measles.
How do you dose vitamin A?
Yeah. Well, vitamin A is actually an interesting thing. If I could just back up a little bit, it's an oral drug. You give it once daily for 2 days. And there is data in Africa. If you look at some meta-analyses where they'll combine a couple of RCTs, randomized controlled trials that were done in Africa, it actually reduces mortality by like, you know, 60-70%, which is pretty remarkable. And if you look at some studies that were done in the United States, because it may be tempting to just say that's not generalizable, there is some data that was done in New York, for example, in the 1990s that showed that kids in New York that had measles, about a fourth of them had really low vitamin A levels. And there's also some data showing that in American children that you can have worse measles symptoms with low vitamin A. And the kids that have low vitamin A also have lower antibody responses to measles. So there is definitely something going on there. So if they're hospitalized, I give it once a day orally. And then if they're shown to be, you know, to have like a low level, I believe you give another dose like a month or so later as a third dose. So probably get a vitamin A level as well if you're very suspicious or confirm the dose of the diagnosis of measles.
Yeah, that was going to be my question about that level of the vitamin A, whether we should be following that up. So sounds like getting that with our initial makes sense, because, you know, I always learned that, you know, A is like one of those, one of the fat soluble vitamins. So I always worry, like, I don't want to overdose them either on the vitamin A. So,
yeah.
You know, you don't have to know the answer to this, and there might not be an answer to this, but roughly, what's the pathophysiology behind vitamin A?
Yeah. I don't really know, to be honest with you. I do know there is some data showing that it seems to correlate with lower antibody levels to measles. And so that may have something to do with it. It does have some, you know, general effects on the immune system. But that's about as much as I can tell you guys.
That's okay. I was not necessarily expecting it. I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, that's a great question, though.
And so, you know, kind of sticking with the measles piece, what about, if it's not a treatment, what about post-exposure prophylaxis and or giving the vaccine after you already have measles? Can you kind of talk about what we can do as soon as you make that diagnosis, if not to treat it better, but to do something else?
Yeah. So, you know, exposures are, you know, obviously a big deal, because, you know, a lot of kids will have some sort of exposure. You know, again, remember that Metrodome story where everybody in the darn building was exposed, and you're going to have to figure out, well, how do I prevent this disease in some of these kids? And, you know, the incubation period can be up to like a couple of weeks or so, or actually, you know, 8 to 12 days, a couple of weeks. And so it could be brewing. And so you got a couple of tools at your disposal that you can use. One is vaccine. So if this is someone who's immunocompetent, And that's important. You could vaccinate him if it's within 3 days of the exposure. And you can even go down to 6 months of age. But it's a live virus vaccine, obviously. So you don't want to do that if this is like an oncology patient or something that's been exposed. And then you can do IVIG. And so you're giving passive prophylaxis there, particularly for folks that are immunocompromised and can't get that live virus vaccine. And that's best if you give it within like 6 days or so of exposure, if I remember rightly.
And then is the, sorry, just to be clarify, extra here. When you're talking about giving the vaccine, are you referring to giving it to the child with measles, or are you talking about giving it to anybody who has seen it?
Oh, no, this would be to somebody as a prophylaxis. So like there's been an exposure. The child doesn't have measles. They were at Chuck E. Cheese birthday party on Saturday, and on Monday they get the call that, you know, the guest of honor at Chuck E. Cheese has measles. Then you could go ahead and, assuming they're healthy, you could give that kid the measles vaccine within that 72-hour window to hopefully prevent them from developing measles if they're not vaccinated. So if they've already got all their shots, then they're good.
Okay. And so there's no value to an extra dose, et cetera?
No, not at that point. No, no.
Okay. And actually, along those lines, and then I know Chris or Brian might ask a little bit about more stopping the spread, but just while I have this kind of topic here, what are the rates of transmission to someone who is vaccinated? So if I have the vaccine and I kind of come around and I got an exposure, should I be worried at all? In the same way, should I walk into that patient's room and say, hey, I'm vaccinated, I'm good, I'm going to walk in, no N95 and everything because I got some titers in me?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, with little kids, if you have a one vaccine in you, it's not that you need a booster dose, but there's about a 95% seroconversion response rate. So that's why we give the second dose. And so for kids that have had one, there is a higher risk that they could get it. If you've had two shots, it's around a 99% protection. So you're pretty good, although nothing's 100%, but you're probably around 99-ish percent protected if you've had two. And if you've had wild type measles, which most people haven't, then you're also, you know, you're probably even a little bit better off than that.
Gotcha.
So it sounds like it happens, but are there people who are non-responders to the MMR vaccine?
There are some, yes, but it is very rare, very, very rare. And I don't know numbers on that, but it is about 99 to 100% seroconversion rate after two vaccines.
Do we want to ask about treatment with rubella then? Is it the same way? Do we have to worry about vitamin A?
No, not that I'm aware of. I don't think that we give vitamin A for rubella. And there really isn't any treatment that I'm aware of for rubella, unfortunately. We don't have any antivirals. I don't think there's any data on giving vitamin A. So that's a different process there. And I'll say IVIG too is not really recommended after exposure either. So even with pregnancy, which you worry about with congenital rubella syndrome, there's no real formal recommendation to give IVIG because it hasn't really been documented to change outcomes sufficiently, which is interesting.
You know, as we kind of wrap up a little bit on the measles piece, I actually had one thought that I was hoping you could help me with. This is the kid, you know, we brought up this case of Casey Koplik, who is a 3-year-old who's unvaccinated, right? We have the records. We knew this piece. We know this person is unvaccinated versus, hey, you're 7 months old and you haven't actually received your MMR. When I walk into I'm just thinking about how I walk into a 7-month-old room in this case, and is there, because it will never come to the top of my head. I mean, it's starting to now, and this is why we're having this conversation, but like, I know for the last 7 years that I've been a doctor that like, I have not walked into the room and thought measles in a 7-month-old with URI symptoms. Is there anything that I should think about or know or anything along those lines that we, I don't know, when it's a baby who hasn't received the shots and I'm not thinking unvaccinated at that moment?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's maternal immunity. And so that's something to think about where, you know, the transplacental passage of antibodies will provide some protection. And that's why we don't vaccinate until around a year of age with the MMR vaccine, with the live vaccine, because we want to wait for those antibody levels for mom to decrease. And that happens around 6 to 9 months, which is why in an outbreak setting, you can vaccinate to 6 months of age. A 7-month-old, though, is kind of in that window where, you know, you could, in theory, get infected because that's where you might start to see those waning levels. So I don't think about it either. I totally agree with you, but it is a possibility. And then, of course, there's a mom who maybe wasn't vaccinated or and never had measles, and so she wouldn't have any antibodies to pass on to her child. So I have that same cognitive bias. I don't think about it in infants.
Yeah. And then, of course, we can think about it when we're in the room. You know, that was just whether there was preemptive thoughts and how we're walking into that room. You know, we talked about walking in with an N95, you know, that type of thing, and probably would not end up doing that for that kid. But that's okay, it sounds like. And it sounds like I have close to 99% immunity anyways. So it should be okay.
Right.
Should we move on to mumps?
Let's move on to mumps. Let's complete the second M of that MMR. So...
Which M? Is it the first M or the second M?
Dealer's choice.
Yeah, I've heard of it as the second M, measles, mumps, rubella.
We'll label that as expert opinion, okay?
That is expert opinion, yeah.
Well, you are still in Cashlack Children's Hospital, and Mikey Mumps, a previously healthy yet unvaccinated 18-year-old, presents to the urgent care with acute pain and swelling of his right testes. For the past week, he's had intermittent low-grade fever and URI symptoms. He denies any dysuria, discharge, or flank pain. He denies any recent sexual activity. What's the classic presentation of mumps?
Yeah. So mumps' classic presentation is painful parotid swelling. That's going to be seen in 90-ish percent. It's going to be bilateral most of the time in about two-thirds or more, but it can start unilateral. And then there'll be a brief prodrome of a day or so with very nonspecific symptoms, which would never make any human being think of mumps, like fever, malaise, and headache alone before the parotid start. Yeah. The other thing I'll say is that peritonitis can cause adjacent pain. So your ear could hurt, side of the neck could hurt, kind of referred pain you can see as well. But that's sort of a classic case of mumps.
And then I guess how frequently is the orchitis that we always hear about in the textbook? You know, you're talking parotid, yeah, big time. That's 99%. You know, what about this orchitis piece?
Yeah, you can see that. I think it's like a fourth, maybe, you know, roughly, that you can see with orchitis. The thing that's interesting about that is, I think in general, if I could, you know, maybe go off script a little bit, what I think is kind of fascinating about mumps is some of the big name complications can occur without peritonitis. So you can have orchitis with no parotid gland swelling. The other big thing you think about with mumps is encephalitis and CNS stuff. And something like a half of the kids that end up with CNS disease actually don't have peritonitis either. So it's the kind of thing where you have to be kind of an astute clinician. You might see an encephalitic kid come in who's unvaccinated, you know, has a CSF pleocytosis, and mumps is on the differential even without the peritonitis.
So what type of other complications could we need to worry about when we're diagnosing someone or considering mumps?
Yeah, I mean, so complications from the orchitis, you can sometimes see testicular atrophy. You can have some infertility, but not as much as you might think. The encephalitis we mentioned, and you can die from that. So our best data from that in the modern era probably comes from Japan, where they don't actually use the mumps vaccine. And when you look at some of the Japanese data, they'll have hearing loss in like 1 in 1,000 kids with mumps, and about 1% of those that get encephalitis can end up dying from that. Keeping in that CNS vein, there's transverse myelitis, which a lot of things can cause, but mumps can do it. And then there's some, you know, less frequent kind of scattered reports of things like myocarditis, pancreatitis, glomerulonephritis, things like that.
And as far as mumps goes from a transmissibility standpoint, you know, we were kind of talking about how prevalent it is. Measles, maybe not as prevalent, but becoming more prevalent and super transmissible, so it can get anywhere regardless. Rubella, similar, but totally doesn't exist in America, and it would all be international cases, you know, that type of thing. Where are we for mumps for that world?
Yeah, so it's also, so I think all three of those in the MMR are pretty aggressive with an attack rate. So the attack rate of mumps is probably like 80-ish percent, you know, 90%. So it's pretty transmissible. It's not quite like measles. I don't know if you could catch it in, you know, the Metrodome on the upper deck, but it's still pretty impressive. And again, if you go back to like the pre-vaccine days, there were probably like 100,000, 200,000 cases per year in the U.S. So it was pretty common.
And sorry, just a, is it still common or sorry, does it still endemically, is it in America or is it, or do you have to think about patients who have traveled like similar to rubella?
No. Yeah. So you, certainly with travel too, but no, we see this in the United States now. And so it's an interesting phenomenon where, you know, we went from like, you know, a couple hundred thousand cases a year and kind of disappeared. But there's this, especially in adolescents, you'll see kind of a little bump in cases where you might see a few thousand cases a year in the U.S. And it tends to occur classically sort of like college kids who may have a waning in their immune response to the mumps version of the MMR. They go to college, they go into a dorm, they're around a bunch of other people, they're unhygienic, and then they can catch mumps. And so that's classically where you'll see it, some outbreaks on college campuses. So that is absolutely something you can see in the States without any travel.
So how are we treating this now?
Good question. I don't know. I don't think there's much you can do for it outside from vaccinating, but there really isn't a treatment for it or a supplement or an antiviral, unfortunately.
They can't just put ice packs on their parotids or on their groin or something like that and they'll feel better?
Sure. Supportive care for sure. Yeah. As the ID doctor, I like to focus on what can I do to kill the virus, but you're absolutely right. So you could certainly like, you know, antipyretics, you know, things to address the pain and the swelling, 100%. Good point.
And we kind of skipped diagnosis on that point, just kind of shoot past it for a second. Chris, you got so excited to put ice packs on everything. the diagnosis-wise, can you kind of walk us through if we're seeing bilateral peritonitis in the setting of kind of, you know, malaise, that fever, that type of thing, what should we be doing?
Yeah, so you'll see a similar trend, PCR and serologies. So those are our toolbox for this. And so for this, you'll swab for a PCR in the buccal mucosa. Stenson's duct is a really nice one. They'll say it has high yield. I haven't seen any data comparing like Stenson's duct swab versus non-Stenson's duct swab, but it kind of makes sense. And then your IgM testing as well. The PCR will turn positive basically around the time the parotid swelling is there, and it'll go away after like a week or so. And then your IgM will turn positive after about a week. So I think you could think of this like early on in the first, you know, week or so from the parotid swelling, the PCR is good. When the parotid swelling starts to go away, which is around 7 days, then your IgM becomes your best method for testing. So you could do both, certainly, but you're going to put a little more weight on the IgM if the kid's like 7 days into his peritonitis. If it's a day or two in, your weight's going to be way more on your PCR coming back positive. And the other thing I'll say on the testing, if you're working up a kid with encephalitis, you can also order that PCR off the CSF too.
Once we make the diagnosis of mumps, is this something we're also notifying the our local health authorities about, similar to measles?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly right. Yeah. Because, we need to keep track of this and make sure there's no outbreaks that are developing.
And one more question about the diagnosis piece. What was if they didn't have the peritonitis? You know, we talked about some of the other cases where they didn't have peritonitis. I wouldn't know to swab the buccal mucosa. The first question, I guess, if they aren't symptomatic from that, can you still swab it and will it be positive? And if not, should we swab something else or just all base it on the IgM?
Yeah, I think in that case, I have to be honest, I don't know the data on that, like the accuracy of a buccal PCR without peritonitis. That's a great question. I'll plead ignorance.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine.
But it's a great spot on question. I mean, if it's like a kid that has encephalitis, I'm going to go right off the CSF. Right. That's where the money is. That's your PCR. And then I agree, I'd probably hit the IgM or look for a fourfold rise in your IgG titer in the absence of the peritonitis. I'd probably swab as well. And try to look into that a little more, look at the data. But I think then you're looking more at your serologies or your PCR off your CSF.
And then just to kind of wrap up the final piece that we just talked about also with measles and rubella, post-exposure prophylaxis, giving the MMR vaccine. It sounds like we're dealing with people that are older than one in this case. But what do you generally recommend?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So, you know, a lot of this is actually probably waning immunity. It's a little different than measles. Measles vaccine's pretty good in terms of immunity, but you do see this waning. So, during an outbreak, you can give a third MMR to folks, even if they've had two MMRs. And it's, you know, why that happens, like why does the vaccine, not work so much for mumps? It's unclear. You know, there's probably just some waning immunity there. Interestingly, that vaccine strain is for one genotype, which is A, but there's another genotype, which is G, which isn't covered as well. And then there could be some antigenic mismatch. So we're still using the same strain of mumps. It's called the Gerald Lynn strain that we were using in 1963. And so there are some strains that folks think just have evolved where there's some mismatch to that vaccine. And interesting trivia. Can I insert some trivia? Okay. The Gerald Lynn strain was named after, anyone know where that name came from?
I'm going to go with Gerald Lynn, but I don't know when I passed that.
Correct. It was Gerald Lynn. She was the daughter of this guy, I forgot his name. I think it was Hillman, who was the lead mumps vaccine researcher in the 60s. That was his daughter. When she got mumps, he swabbed her, got the virus, and then made the vaccine from that, and then named the vaccine strain after his daughter, who's Gerald Lynn Hillman. Yeah.
That's awesome. And he clearly was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make her better. This is going to, you know, inspired for that moment.
Also, the pre-IRB era.
Very true. I do have one more question just to, and this could be my ignorance, and sorry guys, I'm just taking over with all these questions that end up, I feel like what's just going to happen to me in my life, and so I got to ask now. Roughly differential diagnosis for bilateral peritonitis. If I see bilateral peritonitis, should I be swabbing for mumps off the bat, or is there anything else that kind of I should be thinking about?
That was going to be my question too, yeah.
So nice, all right, good.
Is your pretest probability like so high with bilateral peritonitis? Like, is it pretty much a slam dunk or what?
No, that's a great question. It's a hard consult, hard question, because I think there's a lot of stuff that can do that. So a lot of viruses can do that. So if you kind of look at viruses that cause it, you know, it's often the usual players like adeno and echovirus and influenza and so on and so forth. So a lot of those guys can all cause peritonitis. You can also get peritonitis with rheumatologic diseases. There's this thing called juvenile recurrent peritonitis, where kids every few months will get these you know, non-infectious peritonitis. So I think things I would kind of think about with sending mumps is like age of the kid. So if the kid's fully vaccinated and is kind of school age, way less excited about mumps. Most times bilateral. It also tends to be painful as well. So you kind of look in like, is there pain? Is it bilateral? How old's this kid? What's their vaccination status? And then kind of just decide if I'm going to work for mumps or not.
All right. I think I'm good. I think I hit everything I got for right now. Brian, do you want to take it away to the next case?
Let's do it. We've got one last case.
A pox.
Pox upon your house, the Chew Man. Unfortunately, we can't hit all the vaccine preventables today, but we'll hit one more. Dr. Doherty, you get an EMR message from the parents of Polly Pox. She is a 70-year-old unvaccinated female with a history of eczema and maybe a history of some other atopy like asthma. She has had 3 days of fever and a new pruritic and vesicular rash, which is different than her previous eczematous rash. The family sends an image of the rash, which shows at least 100 or maybe more clear fluid-filled vesicles over the face, trunk, and extending onto the extremities. The parents are concerned that she is so uncomfortable. Would you tell us a little bit about the presentation of varicella and just dive right into this presumptive diagnosis of a pox upon your house?
Yeah. Yeah. So chicken pox, I like to say it's one of those things that, you know, happens often enough you need to know about it, but not often enough that you know about it. And it's kind of a tricky one. And it the classic picture is that you'll get this, prodrome of a day or so, where again, it's no rational doctor would think of chickenpox in the prodrome phase until the rash starts. So it's like fevers and myalgia and stuff. And then you get this rash, and it'll start typically centrally, scalp, trunk, face, things like that, and then move out to the extremities last. And it tends to be worse on the central area of the body. Classically, you get these lesions in different stages. So you'll get like a true vesicle, then you'll have just like a red macule, and then you'll have a something that's crusted over. So different stages. And you'll hear this like dewdrop on a rose, where you have like a vesicle sitting on an erythematous base. And so typically you'll see this kid who's got these like lesions in different stages with a mild prodrome, they're unvaccinated. And then you start thinking that this, you know, holy cow, this could be chickenpox. It's also a respiratory disease. We forget about that because I think we get tunnel vision on the rash, right? But these kids can have a cough and things like that.
I remember when I was a med student, I was in my, I forget, one of my longitudinal preceptors. And I feel like, you know, chicken pox was just so easily diagnosed. Like, you know, with an experienced clinician, they see the rash, they know it, they don't have to do anything else. Like, is this presentation pretty consistent? I mean, I think that because of how infectious it is, if I remember correctly, like we, as one pediatrician's office, like we didn't even have them come in. Like they're like, you know, they called, the nurse was like, hey, there's possible chickenpox sitting in the parking lot. Doc would run out, look, yep, it's chickenpox, and then run back in so they wouldn't expose anyone. Like, is this something that easy that we can figure out without doing any other testing?
I mean, I think it's easy in the eye of the beholder. So, yeah, I mean, I remember I used to work with a colleague who was in his 70s and had a bit of a temper, and he would always just, like, get so upset when somebody would miss a diagnosis of chickenpox, right? Because, you know, he saw, like, a bazillion cases in the 1980s, you know? And so I think if you're comfortable with it, you can make this diagnosis. But the problem is some folks just haven't seen it that often, and they're thinking, well, is there really chickenpox? Is it not? And so it is in the eye of the beholder in terms of how comfortable you are making this diagnosis. But I would tend to always send some sort of confirmatory testing off just to make sure, just given that the pretest probability has gone down a little bit as well, and to get something documented that this actually was chickenpox. And then you can use that as rationale for, like, prophylaxis on other kids and things like that, and don't have to say, well, I was pretty sure it looked like chickenpox. You know, especially since we don't really have it as commonly as we used to.
And before getting to the diagnosis, which we'll get to in a second, you know, what is the general age that we should expect to see chickenpox for now in the, you know, 2020s rather than the 1980s?
Yeah, so it's a little bit, you know, it's changed a little bit. So interestingly, you know, it used to be like, if I remember rightly, it was like essentially the birth cohort got chickenpox. So basically, like, you know, every person in the U.S. would get it. And it was typically, you know, by the time they were, you know, done with school age. And it's gotten a little bit older. It's shifted just a little bit to some older cohorts than it used to be.
So one question I have is, in terms of presentation, I saw this a couple times actually when I was a resident, is we had a couple of kids who, after their vaccination, they came back to clinic a little while later, and maybe a week or so later, and they looked like they had chicken pox. Is this something that can happen? Is this the actual virus, or is this from the vaccine, or is this a wild type that they're getting otherwise? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, you can see a couple of things. You can absolutely see some lesions after a vaccine. So it is a live virus vaccine. And so there's this really fascinating but small body of literature dedicated to the number of pox lesions in kids. And, you know, one of my favorite studies was where they actually counted the average lesions on kids with full-blown chickenpox. And I can't remember the number, but like the top number was like 1,962. You know, so somebody actually counted every single lesion on that poor kid. But those kids after the vaccine, yeah, they might have like, you know, 20 lesions, less than 50. But that's really what's going on. You can also see breakthrough varicella, where, you know, maybe somebody had one of the varicella shots, and then a year or two later, they get exposed to chickenpox and they get like 50 lesions. And that's can look very similar. And you differentiate that by the proximity to the vaccine.
And are these children all contagious then, if they actually have rash in vesicles?
Yeah, typically no. At that point, you wouldn't consider them contagious. And particularly after the vaccination, because it's the live attenuated virus that's causing those 20 lesions or whatever. So they don't have to be quarantined or anything like that.
I think we should jump to the diagnosis a little bit. You know, you had mentioned, you know, not seeing this every single day, and so therefore we should have some confirmatory testing with which to share with everyone else. How do you make this diagnosis, and can you kind of walk us through what needs to be swabbed?
Yeah, classically PCR is what's going to help here. So PCR of a lesion, so you would ideally unroof a lesion and then swab the base. That's going to give you the best yield. And so grabbing a scalpel from the nurse's station or wherever you keep it, or a sterile blade, and then unroof a fresh looking lesion and swab that base. And that's gonna give you the best yield. You can also look at an IgG. That'll turn positive pretty quickly, ironically, just a few days after symptom onset. IgM, interestingly, has pretty poor specificity and sensitivity for this. So the recommendation is not really to rely on IgM testing, which is different than some of the other stuff we were talking about. So we were extolling the positive virtues of IgM testing with measles, for example, and rubella, but not so much with chickenpox.
And, you know, actually, as we talk about unroofing lesions in like a 4-year-old or a 7-year-old, that's always fun, as they can probably not going to like that. We kind of didn't really mention just how the vesicles are going to feel. Classically, everyone thinks of the chickenpox as itchy. Is this something that's itchy or painful, or one, the other, both? Like, how are those lesions usually experienced?
Yeah, it can be both. I think itchy and painful is a good way to describe it. I think classically I've heard stories about oatmeal baths, you know, being used to kind of help cut down on the itchiness and whatnot. So it's not an asymptomatic rash all the time, no.
And then
Sam asked these questions because he's so young that he didn't have chicken pox as a kid.
That's actually not true. I had chicken pox and went into an oatmeal bath. yes.
Yeah.
That is, I don't know if that's giving away the end. I was probably the end of the pre-vaccine. I don't know if I want to share my total date of birth on this podcast, but yes, I did unfortunately have chicken pox.
I was wondering about that.
So. Yeah.
I did too. Yeah, I'm much older. Yeah,
but exactly. I definitely had it. We had the chicken pox parties back in my day, so I remember all neighborhood kids. I mean, I don't feel that old, but I feel that's the old way of thinking.
And just jumping back to the last piece about the diagnosis, sorry, Chris, to pull us back here. When we're swabbing for PCR. And again, we're kind of talking about, we've talked about pretest probability. Like, we classically teach, especially infectious disease, when it's all about numbers and it's all about kind of empiric testing or empiric treatment and things along those lines. What else should we be swabbing for when we're swabbing this, right? We are going to swab for VZV, which is varicella. Should we also be swabbing for HSV, enterovirus? What other things should we be swabbing while we're doing this?
Yeah, herpes is commonly done. You know, I think you could think a little bit about the clinical history and does it make sense. But, this patient, I believe, polypox had eczema. And so you could see like eczema herpeticum. And so I think that'd be very reasonable to swab for herpes as well in that instance.
But not necessarily enterovirus, like a Coxsackie virus, that type of thing.
I would be, it certainly could be like hand, foot, mouth, but I would probably be more interested in the herpes and the varicella, in part because you could potentially do something about it as well.
Did we talk about treatment?
No, not yet.
We talked about oatmeal baths, but I remember getting calamine lotion. I mean, I had pink stuff all over me, if I remember correctly.
Clearly the highest level of evidence.
I don't even know what we do nowadays.
But when you get beyond the oatmeal baths, we can use, a cyclovir or something you can use. It kind of depends on what the situation is here. So a cyclovir is kind of an interesting thing. For a couple of reasons. So if you're going to use acyclovir to treat, this is super weird, but the recommendation is to wait until, if you're, I got a little, my wires crossed a little bit because I was sort of confusing this with prophylaxis after exposure. But getting back to treatment, so valacyclovir, acyclovir are two great options. Valacyclovir is just the valine ester of acyclovir, so it's more, bioavailable, so it more approximates like IV dosing. And so acyclovir therapy for somebody who has chickenpox, you want to identify high-risk kids. So the average kid who's going to, improve, could have had a chickenpox party in the day, probably doesn't need to have acyclovir. But folks that are higher risk, so immunosuppressed, absolutely. Older kids too, like 12, 13, teenagers tend to get worse outcomes. Skin disease, so this kiddo with the eczema, those are kids that you'd probably lean towards treating.
So probably still about, we kind of ask it each time, post-exposure prophylaxis, and whether, because we have these vaccines now. So that's kind of the thought process. Anything that you'd recommend? All right, we've made the diagnosis and here you are in your family. Yeah. Is everyone going to get it? What should they be getting, vaccine-wise, all that type of good stuff?
Yeah, so you got three boxes that you can think of. Vaccine or active immunity, antibodies or passive immunity, and then medicines. So those are your three boxes. Vaccines are great. So assuming the person is not immunosuppressed, because again, it's another live virus vaccine. So this isn't something for your stem cell transplant crowd. But if you're within 3 to 5 days of the chickenpox exposure at Chuck E. Cheese's, for example, and they're unvaccinated and they're a candidate, you could just give them the vaccine. And that should be able to abort the infection. For folks that can't do that, Varizig. which is really fun to say, that is a varicella immune globulin preparation. So prior to that, we would give IVIG, but this is just enriched antibodies for chickenpox. And the Red Book has ways you can get a hold of that. There's a place in Texas, a place in California, you can get it shipped out, but that's basically passive prophylaxis that you can use. And then this is the super weird thing with acyclovir, valacyclovir, is if you can't do either of those for whatever reason, you can't get a hold of the Varizig, they can't get the vaccine, you can give the acyclovir, but you want to wait until 7 days after the exposure. Which is kind of weird because you think you'd want to start that thing as early as possible. But there's some literature which shows they've actually compared immediate post-exposure prophylaxis to waiting until day seven, and there was a significantly better outcome if you waited until day seven. And that's probably because, yeah, what's the thought there? Yeah, it's super interesting. The theory is that there's two stages of viremia. So roughly speaking, the first stage, it kind of goes to like the visceral organs, and then there's a second viremia, which goes out to the skin. And the theory is that the acyclovir is better equipped, for whatever reason, to handle that secondary viremia that occurs after day seven, not the primary viremia. So you're kind of waiting until the second phase of viremia, and then you give the acyclovir. So it's kind of a weird deal.
What do you got, Sam?
I do have a follow-up question just about this. Sorry, I just got, this is great. I've learned so much.
No, it's been fantastic. I love it.
This has been awesome. When you have patients who have been vaccinated, you know, you say, okay, you know, you got this exposure. I already have the vaccine. I would imagine the transmission chance of that is relatively low, similar to the MMR that we were talking about, especially on the measles side. But can you get the virus still in your system and just be asymptomatic? So like the reason why I say that is when we talk about zoster down the line, is any sort of exposure going to actually now risk someone for zoster versus before they're like, no, I never got chickenpox. I never got VZV. I should never have zoster. Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, that can be confusing because you can get zoster and not have a memory of chickenpox, if I think that's kind of what you're getting at there, if I remember rightly. And so you can get it from the vaccine strain. So it is a live virus. There are some reports of isolating the vaccine strain in zoster lesions. So that's a possibility. Some folks may not have remembered getting chickenpox and actually had it or had a somewhat mild case. So maybe they were infected in between their first and second varicella vaccine, had a mild case, it was blown off. But it still establishes latency, right, in the sensory ganglia. And then lo and behold, it rears its ugly head as zoster when they're 60 or whatever. And so that can absolutely, or when they're younger, young people can get zoster too. So that can happen.
I have a question. We can cut this in case this derails us too much. As we sort of have discussed before, I'm a med peds doc, so I see adults all the time too. And I've recently, in the last couple of years, I feel like I've been seeing a lot more zoster, shingles with my younger adults. And I read somewhere the discussion that there's some thought that because we are now vaccinating our children so much more often, that they don't get wild type infection and therefore don't mildly expose their younger adult parents. And therefore the parents then don't get boosted with shingles and therefore or with varicella and then are getting shingles earlier. I don't know. Have you heard anything about this? Am I totally derailing this discussion?
No, I've heard that too. And I can't speak very well or eloquently to that any more than you did, honestly. But I think that's those are good thoughts. Yeah, I've heard that as well.
I just wanted to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've heard that as well. I'm probably not the best person to answer your question, but I've heard that as well. And it's a great question.
Well, Dr. Doherty, this has been a fantastic conversation. As we look back across these four vaccine-preventable illnesses and then vaccine-preventable illnesses broadly, are there any take-home points that you want us to bring into practice tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a couple of things I'd bring up. One is just keep it in the back of your head at all times. It's so easy when you get busy to just not remember these diseases because you just don't see them, right? We have this cognitive bias of things we know. And so just constantly maintaining that awareness, like, is this chickenpox? Is this measles? Could I be missing something? Is really important. And I am the king of missing things and getting these anchoring biases. So just constantly asking yourself, like, am I missing something here? And then the second thing is just to try to remember those pearls, those red flags for those diseases. So for example, rubella had the posterior auricular and the occipital adenopathy. It's kind of weird, right? Measles had that non-exudative conjunctivitis, right? That was kind of weird. Mumps. Remember how like you can have those serious complications without the peritonitis. So that kid with encephalitis who's unimmunized, don't forget to look for mumps. So think of, and each person may have their own little cheat sheet of like what they need to remember. And so just keep those things in your head. You don't have to remember everything. Just a few high yield things are going to trigger your mind when you walk in that room and you see that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing your last final thoughts with everyone. Before we let you go, is there anything you want to plug? Any societies, websites, tools that you think our listeners should check out before you go?
Yeah, nothing personally. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has got a really great website with vaccines. Paul Offit's like the king of that vaccines, and so that's a really super cool, very helpful website. If you have any questions, particularly for families, to refer families there.
Perfect. That's the perfect type of recommendation we like at the end. So, thank you so much for hanging out with us tonight. We should have you back again to talk about more ID pearls.
Yeah, happy to anytime, and thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Yeah.
Get show notes and sign up for our Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producers for this episode, Natalia Beneshot and Brian Ward, and of course our social media champion, Denise Cruz, on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Azer.
I'm Brian Ward.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you, and good night. And of course, if you made it all the way to the end, I have another wonderful poem written by AI. This one's titled Spotted Signals. Measles marches fever high, complex spots first catch our eye. Then comes the rash head to toe while coughs and coryza flow. Mumps brings pain behind the ear as parotids swell crystal clear. Like wisdom teeth gone quite astray, soft foods rule the patient's day. Rubella subtle, often mild, pink spots pepper face of child. Lymph nodes tender joint my ache, while low-grade fever stays awake. Chickenpox joins this spotty band, with vesicles across the land. First on trunk, then spreading wide, crops of blisters none can hide. Different spots tell different tales, each one with its detailed trails. Through vaccines make them rare to see, we watch for signs of all these three. Plus, BZV! All right, guys.